Tonight we're speaking with Dr. Kathy Pratt. She will be talking about practical ideas for decreasing problematic behaviors. She is the director of the Indiana Resource Center for Autism at the Indiana Institute on Disability and Community, located at Indiana University. She works with children on the spectrum, and she recently earned her BCBA. She's now a board-certified behavior analyst. I'm going to let Kathy tell you a little bit more about herself before we get started. Welcome, Kathy.
Thank you, Nancy. Hello, everyone. Probably the thing that you need to know about me is that I've been involved in the field of autism for about 35 years and have obviously seen some changes in the field and obviously the incredible increase that we see of children being diagnosed on the spectrum. The other thing is that for many years I was a classroom teacher, so I've worked with individuals from 3 to 21 as in a teacher capacity. And then even though I'm associated with a university, I spend a lot of time in schools. And I get called into schools typically because of individuals who are having behavioral issues, but have also been involved in some projects lately to work in schools in implementing evidence-based practices, which has been have been coaching teachers on how to implement those. And it's been incredibly rewarding to be able to do that. Some of the questions that folks had for me, and I apologize, I didn't get to read all of them because I didn't get them until later in the day today, but some of the questions that folks had for me were about services. And I'm aware of services in Indiana, may not be aware of services in other parts of the United States and definitely not in the world. But the other thing that the Indiana Resource Center for Autism does is that we work on policy and working with a legislative commission on making services available. So Indiana was the first state to have an insurance mandate. We have a lot of legislation that has made things available for families. And just like every other state, in this time and economy, we're facing services that are being diminished. So have to become even stronger advocates as we see those changes occur. So, Nancy, is the best way for me to go through questions, or do you want to open it up for questions, or do you want me just to go ahead and do the PowerPoint without people being able to see it?
Do you think we can do that, you know, and be a little bit more descriptive? I was looking through the Autism Support Network website, and you had given there 10 steps towards supporting appropriate behavior, so I was going to go through that list, but we can go through the slideshow first.
Why don't we do that? Because a lot of the questions were about behavior,
right.
And I want to set this up for behavior. So, so I'm going to read the tips so that you know what they say. I wouldn't do this if you had the slides in front of you, but let me just read them. Tip one is know that there is no categorical approach to behavior supports. Accept the fact that there is no single recipe for handling problem behavior because each individual and situation is different. Must understand no individual and the context. So what that is basically saying is that when people come up to me and say, we have a child who does this behavior, here's their diagnosis, there's still a lot of information that I don't have about the individual. I don't know about their opportunities to learn skills, what other issues are going on in their life, what their neurology is, if there's other comorbid conditions, if they're individuals who have high anxiety. So there really isn't an approach that is a recipe. Instead, you have to look at behaviors individually and get to know the individual child. The next slide that kind of goes along with this says, what do we do when? And I get a lot of phone calls from school districts and families who say, we have a child who is doing this behavior. What do we do when they scream? What do we do when they bite? What do we do when they run? What do we do whenever the behavior is? And I've come to realize that, first of all, when people ask me that question, I never know everything that's going on. That doesn't tell me all the entire story. And in truth, when I start asking more and more questions, more of the story starts to come out. And so it's really, I think it's very difficult. And I think one of the things that I would tell you all to resist the temptation of is, I know that family members, and I understand this absolutely, that family members will go to different professionals and say, I have a child who does this, what do I do? And professionals will give you a lot of different kinds of advice. You really need to work with people who really have a good understanding of your situation, really work in a team to really do ongoing collaboration and problem solving, because unless somebody really knows everything that's going on in a situation, it's really hard to provide really accurate and helpful guidance. So I wish that there was a cookbook. I wish there was something that we could say this works for all kids. It just simply doesn't exist. And I have to tell you, as a consultant, I have to meet students and get to know them and understand a little bit about where they're coming from in order to think about strategies that will work for them. So I remember several years ago, a general education teacher asked me, where is the book? And I said, the book? And she goes, yeah, the book that says step one, do this, step two, do this. And we know that that book simply doesn't exist. And we also know that what works one day with your child may not work the next. And if you have more than one child in the spectrum, what works for one may not work for the other. Tip two, the other thing that I've realized is that when people ask me questions about what do we do when, oftentimes what they're looking for is a crisis management response. So what that means is that when you have a child who is hurting themselves, hurting other people, doing property destruction, when you feel that that child is creating or is in danger, that we have to hook into what is called a crisis management response. Because always safety has to be the first concern. If you have a child who is doing something that is dangerous to themselves or others, safety always has to be the first concern. But you need to understand that crisis management is referred to as a short-term intervention because it doesn't result in long-term behavior change. The child does not learn what to do differently. But you do need to address safety. And so if you have a child who you are concerned is going to hurt themselves or hurt others, you need to develop a plan that says, this is how we're going to keep the child safe. This is how we're going to minimize the situation. And really, in that moment, when your child is out of control, your primary goal is not to get your message across. Your primary goal is not to get the last word in. Your primary goal should be really to reduce the situation and to get everybody back to a state of calm. So tip three says, realize that a crisis management approach may actually strengthen or reinforce negative behavior. So let me talk a little bit about the definition of reinforcement and punishment. The only definition of reinforcement is that it increases behavior. The only definition of punishment is that it decreases behavior. And from a child's perspective, if we respond very strongly to an event, if we are very emotional in our response, if you have a child who loves deep pressure and you restrain them, if you have a child who prefers to be alone and you put them in timeout, those may actually be reinforcers for them. So the only way that you can really tell if something is a reinforcer as a punisher is by collecting data on them and to say, is what we're doing decreasing the behavior or is it increasing behaviors? So there have been many students that I've worked with whose behavior has been strengthened by strategies that I thought would diminish behavior. For example, I know kids who like to be in timeout. I know of students who prefer to be expelled from school because then they get to go home. There is one little guy that I've been working with who has tried to figure out every which way to be able to have his mom come and pick him up so he can go home for the day. And fortunately, the staff have responded very neutrally to his attempts, and we've got him to the point where he is actually staying in school and liking staying in school. So we have to be careful that when we use a crisis management approach, that we're not actually making that behavior stronger. So again, if you restrain a child who loves deep pressure, they may continue to engage in that behavior to get that deep pressure fulfilled. need for deep pressure fulfilled. So you have to look at how the individual is responding to the behavior. Tip 4 is always choose your battles. Certain behaviors may be better to ignore. At the very least, always respond with a neutral effect and keep words to an absolute minimum. So when a child has a disability, what I found is in schools, oftentimes their behavior is in a fishbowl. And sometimes the kids do typical behavior. But because they have a disability, we label it as atypical. So it's really important also to understand developmental progressions, how kids develop. For example, if you were to sit down and talk to a parent of a child who does not have any disability and you brought up the time around puberty, you would hear parents talk about how behaviors can become really challenging. And that's going to be true for our folks on the spectrum. That isn't to excuse it. All that I'm saying is that we kind of have to put things in perspective and realize that sometimes the behaviors that are developmentally appropriate or developmentally what other kids would do, we have a tendency to focus on those behaviors a little bit more. I've been in several school situations where the expectations that they place on the students with autism are much higher than they place on the other students to respond in an appropriate fashion. The other thing that this says is that when a child is acting out, really the best thing at that point is to not get into power struggles. When I see folks get into these situations, these power struggles, where somebody's going to have to win and somebody's going to have to lose, realize that the adult will lose sometimes. So you don't want to get into power struggles. Instead, what you want to look at is how does everybody walk out of this as a winner? The other thing that we see is that children go through an escalation cycle. And so what the escalation cycle tells us that when children are the angriest, their quality of judgment is going to be the lowest. So at that point, when they are really angry, that's really not the time for us to explain what they need to do differently. Really, when they are angry, when things are out of control, when they are having behavioral meltdowns, really our goal at that point is to minimize the situation, to reduce the anger, and to keep everybody calm. So, you know, respond with a neutral effect and keep your words to a minimum. Tip 5 says a punitive or generic approach does not address the function of the behavior, and the effects will likely not generalize. Most important, focus on self-control rather than adult-controlled behavioral supports. So what this refers to is that in schools and in homes, what I see oftentimes is that people will have a generic approach to behavior. So in schools, it's when children act out, we send them home, or we put them in timeout, or we do whatever. And really, these approaches have to be individualized. And when you use these generic punitive approaches, it doesn't address the underlying cause or function of the behavior. So I'm going to talk a little bit later about the role of functional behavioral assessment. Functional behavioral assessment is something that is done in schools when an individual, in the United States, when an individual has a history of problematic behavior. And the goal is really to find out what the underlying cause of the behavior is and to develop a program that is more individualized. The other thing that I worry about is that too often people talk about controlling behaviors and that they want to put the control, have the behavior under the adult control. So just so that you understand my bias, I get to see individuals from the earliest point of diagnosis basically to death. And that gives me a really lovely lifespan perspective. And so, you know, I don't know what ages your children are, but when I look at these individuals, if they're 5 or 10 or 15 or whatever, I don't look at them at that age. I look at them as if they are 35. And so when kids are little, what happens is that we can physically move them from one place to the next. And so people will talk about self-control that way. And then I'll be honest with you, in schools, as these individuals get older, what will happen is that larger staff are hired and men are hired that are able to kind of manage the behavior. What you really want to focus on is not how somebody else is going to manage that behavior, but how the individual is going to manage their own behavior. And I have worked in my lifetime with kids with very, very significant behavior problems who have learned how to manage their behavior. One example that I can give you is just that when I was a teacher, I had a student who had a measured IQ of zero, which I think that all that meant was that he went into the testing room and threw the table at the evaluator, in truth. And he hit himself in the head 600 or 700 times a week, very hard in the head, so much so that they were concerned about him blinding himself. When I became his teacher, he came with arm restraints and a helmet that I was supposed to use with him to help to work on minimizing his behavior and keeping him safe. Over time, as I got to know him, what I came to realize was that he liked the deep pressure that the restraints provided, that he liked it when I would go up to him and I would press on his chest. And so over time, we taught him, who was nonverbal, who had a lot of self-injurious behavior, who supposedly had a zero IQ, we taught him to be able to come over to us and ask for deep pressure on his chest by putting our hands on his chest and asking for his arm restraint. And he would put them on himself. We reduced the size of the arm restraints. I'm not a great supporter of those, but for some kids, for him, they were so concerned about him blinding himself that they had tried restraints. And we were able to, over time, and it didn't happen quickly, but over time and over being consistent, is able to reduce his self-injurious behaviors down to 11 a week, and they were much less intense. So even for an individual who has pretty significant challenges, you can focus on self-control, because we're not going to be in these kids' lives all the time. And so always we have to work on how are we going to get the individual ready for that time when we are no longer there for them. Okay, tip 6, think prevention rather than reaction. And when it comes to dealing with problem behavior. And this is very counterintuitive, but the second part of this tip is realize that the best time to address behavior is when behavior is not happening. So let me explain a little bit more. When you are in the midst of a behavior, when the individual is hurting themselves or hurting other people or screaming or whatever the behavior is, at that moment, our goal is really to minimize the situation, to keep the child calm, to diminish the behavior. And then, when the behavior is not happening, that's when we really need to start teaching the child a different way of responding, a different way of behaving. It's not when they're upset. So tip 7 is, we know that, tip 7 says that, know that in order to be maximally effective, a behavior support plan should evolve from a thorough assessment of both the problem behavior and the context of which it occurs. This requires a team approach. So my bias, and this is my bias, you know, again, what you are getting is my bias and my experience and my beliefs about things. But my bias is that I always worry about the use of the term expert, because I really believe in the team approach. And I've been doing this for a lot of years, and I am still learning all the time. I remember a few years ago, I had somebody who called me and said, I'm an expert in autism. I've been doing it for 2 years. And I have to admit that 2 years into it, I probably didn't even know the right questions to ask. So again, let me revisit this concept of functional behavioral assessment, and let me explain it in medical terms. I have a dear friend whose mother is 82 years old, who started losing weight, who started having chronic headaches, who started having chronic diarrhea, was having night sweats. Went to one doctor and said, the doctor said, well, you know, we're going to give you medicine for your headaches. Another doctor said, we're going to give you medicine for your diarrhea. Another doctor said, you need to start drinking Ensure so that you don't lose any more weight. And finally, there was a doctor who said, we're going to have to run tests and figure out what's really happening with you. We're going to have to figure out the underlying cause. And to me, that's what the functional behavioral assessment is when people call me and say, we have a child who is doing this. In truth, what we're being asked to do is to treat symptoms. Instead, what we have to do is to go in there and figure out what is the underlying cause. And unless we figure out that underlying cause, more symptoms will continue to reoccur. And I'm not going to lie to you, sometimes finding that underlying cause is very difficult. But you have to ask a lot of questions and dig. And tip A tells us, remember that behavior serves a purpose for the individual and that our job is to figure out that purpose. So one of the questions that we have to ask ourselves is, what are they getting from this? Why do they keep doing this behavior? Because what we know about behavior is that kids keep engaging in behavior because they get something from it. It may not make sense to us, but there's some payoff. There's something that they're getting from the behavior, and we have to figure out what that payoff is. So tip 9 is that as we're looking at behavior, we look at antecedents, we look at the behavior, we look at consequences. So as you look at antecedents, there are two types of antecedents. For students on the spectrum, we have slow triggers or setting events. And those antecedents are the ones that are most often important for these kids. We also have fast triggers or immediate antecedents. So the immediate antecedents are things like if there's a vacuum cleaner that runs, you know the child hates the noise and will have a behavior. If they're around another student or another child, you know that a behavior will occur. If you ask your son or daughter to do something specifically, you know that the behavior will occur. You know that if an individual uses a certain word around them. For example, I had a student who hated the word no. And if you use the word no with them, then the behavior would go off. You know that if your child doesn't win at the game, that their behavior will go off. These are things that you know, you can look at and you can see, if this happens, we know that the behavior will occur. The antecedents that for our students that I think are sometimes the most important ones are those things that are called setting events. Okay? So you have your immediate antecedents. Those are things like vacuum cleaners, saying a certain word, asking them to do something special. And then you have your slow triggers, which are setting events. And these are things that you may or may not see, but these are conditions that increase the likelihood that your child may have a problematic behavior. So one mom explains it this way. She says, when my son is feeling well, when his medication is good, when things are good at home, when things are good at school, when all the stars and planets are aligned, I can ask him to do something pretty tough, and he will do it. On those days where he's not feeling well, when things are not good at home, when things are not good at school, when his medication is off, when he's not sleeping, I can ask him to do the same thing, and he will have challenging behaviors. So if you look at it from our life, probably all of you have routines. I have a morning routine. If my morning routine is broken, my day is off a little bit more. Okay? So some of the triggers or setting events that you may see for some of these kids include anxiety, which is major for our students on the spectrum, and biological issues. You know, there is a belief that I hold also, and again, this is just a personal belief, but I believe that there is a biomedical aspect to some of these kids. Even as a teacher, and if you look at the work of Kanner, you would read the person who first diagnosed autism. He would talk about the bowel issues of these kids. So when I see a child on the spectrum and they have dark circles under their eyes, or I know they have a history of chronic ear infections, or they have gastrointestinal difficulties, loose bowels, impacted bowels, whatever it is, that I know that that will have an impact on behavior. I also know that, and I'm not a physician, so I can't provide guidance on this, but I know for some of our kids, they benefit from dietary and supplements. And, you know, if they are well, if they're healthy, they're going to be able to learn. The problem is that sometimes these things are difficult for families and professionals to detect. If there are schedule or staff changes, that can lead to behavior difficulties. In Indiana, we've had a really rough winter, and we've had a lot of cancellations or delays. And our teachers in Indiana have actually developed schedules for when there's school delays to help kids. Medications that are changed or missed, and again, I'm not a physician, so I'm not going to be talking about specific medications. But what I know is that medicating a child with autism is more of an art form than a science. And not every child will respond the same way to medications. And I also know, and this is as a non-medical provider, that sometimes more is not better. Irregular sleep patterns. So we know many of our folks on the spectrum don't sleep well. And if they're not sleeping, they're not going to be able to do their best. Illness or impending illness. So often as a teacher, I would have a student who would have difficulties, behavior difficulties, and then a few days later, they would become ill. Missed meals, excessive hot or cold temperatures. If the child has arguments or fights with classmates, parents or teachers, difficulties on the bus, skill deficits, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a second. If they don't have a communication system, and we know that there is a strong link between communication and behavior, that kids have to have a way to communicate to us. And even students who have very good verbal skills, who can use a lot of words with us, they still may not have the ability to communicate. And then sensory issues can all be upsetting events. And so as those things are present in a child's life, they may make it more and more difficult for them to be able to engage and learn different ways of responding. So tip 10 is critical to understand concepts of reinforcement and punishment, and I've talked about that a little bit. When looking at consequences, it's important to understand the consequence from the perspective of the individual, and with this in mind, realize that we may intentionally or unintentionally reinforce problematic behavior. Focus on positive consequences, reinforcement, in terms of those things that maintain or strengthen behavior. Consequence, the only definition of consequence, is that it comes after behavior. Unfortunately, oftentimes when we talk about consequences, we always talk about it in terms of the negative or punitive resources. But you think about consequences, because we all work for consequence. The consequence of me going to work every day is that I get a paycheck, and I love doing what I do. Those are the consequences. And those consequences keep me going back to work because they reinforce me for doing what I'm doing. I think what we have to be careful about, though, is in situations, the behaviors that we may be reinforcing. So let me give you an example from my own life. I would like to say to you that I always respond to behavior perfectly, but believe me, I don't. I've inherited two grandkids who have taught me a lot about behavior and my own human frailties. So a typical scene in a restaurant may be that the three-year-old is asking for a certain kind of food or a certain kind of toy, and he starts to cry, and he starts to get upset. And finally, when his behavior accelerates so much that people are looking at us, we all give in and we give him what he wants. What we have taught him in that moment is, in order to get what I really want, I have to get really loud and upset. So we have given him the cue, we have given him the behavior that he needs to engage in order to get what he wants. So always, as we have to look at our behavior, and what is our behavior teaching children? Going through the grocery store line, the child asks for candy, we say no, the child starts screaming and becoming more insistent. Finally, when we realize everybody's looking at us, we finally just give the child the candy. We have now taught them, in order to get candy, get upset. Okay. Tip 11, realize that not everything impacting an individual's behavior is related to their autism. Sometimes it is not about autism, but rather resources, quality of life issues, or other events in an individual's life. When a child has a disability label, we have a tendency to reduce everything about their behavior to their disability label. But I know, and I've seen this repeatedly, that when children have more options in their life, when they have a more fulfilled life, that overall their behavior will be more positive. Ted Carr, who is this incredible behaviorist, who unfortunately died a couple years ago, got up in front of 2,000 behavior consultants and said, quite simply, when people are happier, the better they behave. Just recently, I saw a man with autism who is starting to engage in some challenging behaviors and saying some pretty negative things. And as I looked at his life and as I worked with his family, what I came to realize is that in their goal to keep him safe, they had restricted his life so much that he was bored, that he didn't have a lot of options. And always with families, it's a matter of reasonable risk, but you want your child to have a fulfilled life. You want them to have relationships. And so as we've been working with this man, we're trying to open up the opportunities for him. And the result is that we're seeing behaviors improve. So tip 12 is that behavior support plans should logically evolve from hypotheses you develop. This is going to be hard to explain to you. And so when you see the grid or the pathway, it'll make more sense. But let me kind of walk you through it. This is a pathway that has four boxes. The first one says setting events. The second one says triggering end of scenes. The third one says problem behavior. And the fourth box says maintaining consequence. So this is a young woman who has tremendous anxiety, incredible anxiety. Her setting event is that she has a lot of anxiety. She also has some biological problems. She has social skills deficits. What she really wants in life is to have a friend. And she doesn't want to share that friend with anybody else, and she doesn't want that friend to have any other friends. She also, even though she is so bright, she also has practical conversational difficulties. She cannot really tell you what she's thinking and feeling. She also puts a lot of stress on herself to do things perfectly. And she can draw pictures, she can replicate pictures from magazines beautifully, but she notices a little bit of shading off, and so she will just tear it up. So the behavior for her is, well, let me go to the triggering end scene. So setting events, triggering end of scenes. The triggering end of scenes is that she will see a student violating rules. She believes that there is a difference between public and private behavior. And that the rule is that you do not do private behavior in schools. And she identifies private behavior as holding hands and hugging. In most of our high school hallways, you will see holding hands and hugging. So when she sees students doing that, what she will do is that she will yell at them and publicly chastise the students. What she gets out of it is that she gets a small release of anxiety, she gets staff attention, and she gets the students to stop. So typically what happens is that I get called in, as I did in this situation, and the question to me is, how do we help her understand she can't do this? How do we punish her? Okay, and they use this in a generic form. What is it the consequence we deliver that makes her realize she can't do this? So the school decided that they would send her home when she did this behavior. Well, in truth, she preferred to be home. She would rather be home. And then the challenge is, how do we get her back into school? I really believe that the majority of our behavior programming has to focus on the setting events, dealing with the biological problems, dealing with the anxiety, and addressing the social skills deficits. So tips 13, let me lead into that. We have to make the teaching of alternative responses an integral part of our behavior response plan. In truth, IEP goals should be stated in the positive and not the negative. In ABA, we refer to this as fair pair. So what I found is that when people are talking about behaviors, we are really good at identifying the behaviors we want to do away with. But we have to be equally as good, if not better, at being able to identify in very specific terms what are the alternative skills that you want the child to learn. You can never take a behavior away without replacing it with an alternative. And you can't assume that if you take that alternative away, that the child will be able to come up with that alternative on their own. So teaching alternative behaviors or specific behaviors, what we want to do is that we want to come up with a behavior, an alternative behavior, a pro-social behavior that is as effective and as efficient as the problem behavior. And some of those behaviors include, and I'm not going to go into them in depth, but they may include problem-solving skills, choice-making ability, self-management and control, communication, social skills. These are all behaviors that we need to be focusing teaching children and are sometimes very complex skills. Tip 14 is that we want to utilize effective instructional approaches. So I'm going to just go through a few of these. Choice. There's a lot of research that says when individuals are given choices, that participation increases and behavior decreases. So not everything in life is a choice. It is not a choice whether you go to bed or not. But it is a choice about whether there is a light on. There is a choice about kind of pajamas you sleep in. There is a choice about if you read a book or you read a book. So if you can think about how you build in choice for kids, because I really believe, and again, this is just my belief, but I really do believe that when you take these kids with autism who already feel some lack of control because of their disability, and we take more control away from them, I think sometimes kids act out just to be able to have some control over their life. So if we can identify ways that we can give them some control, that may help to alleviate that. The next one is incidental teaching, and these are evidence-based practices. And all that incidental teaching means is that we are coaching kids all the time. Every moment is a teachable moment. We know, for example, that in teaching social skills, that the best way to teach social skills is in context, because our folks on the spectrum have a difficult time with generalization, so teaching them social skills in a clinical setting does not mean that they're going to be able to generalize those to the real-world setting. Working on communication in a clinical setting doesn't mean that your child will be able to communicate in a real-world setting. So all the time we're coaching children on what they need to do. The next one is about increasing praise and rapport. And I tell teachers that students with autism will do more for you if they know you like them. A parent of a child with autism said that she realized that a lot of her interactions, she's also a teacher, that she realized that a lot of her interactions with her child and also with her students was that she would tell them things like, don't do this, no, stop doing this. And so what she started doing is that she started saying things more positively and giving them positive information. So one of the challenges that I would give all of you, and this is a challenge, this is something I used to do as a teacher, is take a piece of paper and draw a line down the middle, and on one side write positive comments, on the other side write negative comments. And in the privacy of your own home, and nobody needs to see this, jot down, do a tally mark every time you see a positive comment to your child. Nice job. Why don't you try it this way? Every time you do a positive comment, write a check mark. Every time you do a negative, stop it. I told you not to do that. Write a check mark. And that's right. And what the research says is this, is that our positives should outweigh our negatives 8-1 or 7-1. Okay. Provide clear expectations. Sometimes students don't know what they're supposed to do. That's true for all of us. I mean, I'm sure that all of you have been in situations where people will tell you to do something and you have no idea what it is you're supposed to do. You and I have coping strategies that we will look around and we will figure it out. But I have seen so many kids who really don't know what they're supposed to do. Recently I saw a child, and this was so blatant to me, who he would be given directions or he would hear another student be given directions, and he would follow those directions and then get punished because he was not supposed to do that. So realize that our folks have some processing difficulties as well. Increase predictability, and we promote the use of a lot of visual supports for kids. Our words are fleeting, but if they have visual supports, it will help them cope with the day. And most of us are visual learners, too. I'm a list maker. Don't read me letters. Let me read them myself. I'm going to put a caveat on this next one. The next one that I say is build routines. But here's the caveat that I'm going to put on this, is that what we know about life is that change will happen. And so if every day you do the same thing with your child, you will make it more, will make them more resistant to change. So maybe the routine is that every Saturday morning you get up and you build a schedule for the day. But every Saturday morning you get up and you add different things into that schedule. So the child is used to some change and some unpredictability. Direct and specific feedback. So instead of just saying good job, nice job of picking up your toys so that you're very specific with the child. And then again, reinforcement strategies. Reinforcement strategies are so critical to think about how we purposely reinforce kids. And the standard rule is that when a child is first learning something, you reinforce heavily. And then when they have the skill, when they know the skill, then you go from continual reinforcement to intermittent reinforcement. So you don't reinforce all the time. But intermittent reinforcement is really powerful for sustaining behaviors over time. And, you know, kids with autism tell us what their reinforcers are. Their reinforcers are their fixations oftentimes. As a teacher, I would have students who their fixations, I had one student whose fixation was talking about blood donations. I am not good with blood, but if he did certain work, he and I would talk about blood donations, and that was reinforcing for him. So kids will tell you what's reinforcing. Tip 15 is that the ultimate focus should be on long-term strategies that support families and individuals and that maintain behavioral change. And some of those examples of long-term strategies include kids having to have an acceptable means of communication, that there has to be a communication system in place. And, you know, there's all different kinds of literature and belief about whether it should be sign language or picture symbols or low-tech or high-tech. I don't really care. I think the main thing about communication system is that it has to enable the child to be able to tell us important messages. And I have to tell you, I've seen a lot of kids recently who have been communicating using the iPads. I love the iPads, and I think those are really opening up the opportunities for our kids. We focus on other long-term strategies, including a focus on self-monitoring and self-management. We do a lot of work and visit the website for the Indiana Resource Center for Autism. I'm blessed with an amazing staff who writes fabulous articles. And I have a colleague who has written things about natural supports and circles of friends, person-centered planning processes. And then we're always looking at how to get families linked to communities resources because we know that that's important. Tip 16 is that behavior support plans must be doable within the context in which an individual lives, works, and attends schools. And this contextual fit is really important because sometimes folks will make behavior support plan ideas that just don't fit the setting. And if they don't fit the setting, then we're not going to be able to do them. So you have to be aware of the values of the other things that are going on in families' lives. Families realize that your primary role is to be a parent. And clinicians who encourage you or create programs that are not going to be realistic and reasonable within the family structure, work with them to make it work. And one of the things that I know about families, and I'm not a parent of a child on the autism spectrum, been doing this for a lot of years, but I don't live with it daily. And one of the things that I know about parents on the autism spectrum is that, first of all, they would do anything for their sons and daughters. They would give up their lives for them. But secondly is that they're a parent first, and they oftentimes have other things in their life. Take care of yourselves. Take care of your relationships. Take care of your other children. You're in this for the long haul, and we have to help you to be able to preserve yourself for the long haul. Tip 17 is the outcome of a good behavior support plan is not so much that there is a reduction in problem behavior, but rather that there is an increase in alternative behavior. So really, when a behavior support plan really works, don't just focus on this behavior's gone away, but the focus should be on what has my child learned to do differently? What is the pro-social skill that they have learned? Tip 18 is that bear in mind that in order for behavior plans to work, they must be followed. And let me just make the comment here is that behavior plans, one of the reasons that I see them not working is because they're not followed. And they're not followed because people don't have a buy-in with them or they don't have a good fit for the context. Make sure that all have reached consensus concerning the course of actions and that there is a mechanism for ongoing communication and monitoring of progress. So I sit in a lot of meetings. I see people hold hands, sing kumbaya, reach consensus. But if you do not agree with a team decision, one of the rules, one of the credos of teams is that when you walk out of a meeting, and this is true, husbands and wives, school teams, you know, and families, adult services and families, when you walk out of that meeting, you walk out with one voice. And if you disagree with that team decision, you have to go back and make that team meet again. Tip 19 is realize that effective behavior change may require that all involved in the individual's life change their behavior as well. In schools, I tell teachers that I work with two different kinds of people, the but and the and people. The but people say, but it won't work, but we don't have the time, but we don't have the resources, okay? And I have to tell you that if all you see are barriers, you're right, things won't happen. But I have to work with and people, and I can do this, and I can do that. And you all need support to be supported to see those ends, those opportunities. The other thing that we know is that if you keep doing what you've always done, you're going to keep getting what you've always gotten. And I think the hardest thing about behavior, when you are dealing with people with behavior issues, is to say, what is my role in this? You know, what can I do differently? What is my child trying to tell me with this behavior? You know, why do they keep doing this behavior? What is the payoff from this behavior? So tip 20 is changing behavior requires honesty. We've got to be honest with each other. A willingness to change, and I talked about that a little bit, it requires relationship building. I was so blessed as a teacher. And I have to tell you, I have stayed involved with the Autism Society all these years because when I first got involved with autism, there was not a lot out there. And my family and I were talking about the other day, they were marveling at the fact that when I first got involved in autism, that my family didn't know what it was. And they would talk about it, and I was always explaining what autism is. Now the reality is very different for me. When I go and I talk to people about what autism is, what I find is that people will tell me, oh, I have a child. Oh, I have a cousin. Oh, I have a grandchild. It is so much more common now. And through the years, the Autism Society and working in collaboration with the local chapters have been the people who have really taught me about autism, and then my friends on the spectrum who have taught me so much. We are all learning together. And I wish that there was an easy answer. I wish there was a recipe, but it really does require us coming together and building relationships to make things happen. And I think the final thing is that, you know, you have to have a plan and follow it calmly and get a lot of people engaged in helping you think about the plan, because it may take a while. A lot of these kids have gotten very deeply entrenched in their behaviors, and going back and breaking behaviors of kids who are resistant to change, who develop a lot of habits, is going to be very difficult to do. Okay, Nancy, I think that's my formal presentation.
I thank you for your flexibility there. That was awesome. Even though, you know, it wasn't the slideshow that we were anticipating, it was still very visual for me. I still was able to see all the slides in my head. And will
people have access to the slides later?
Yes, they will. The slides will be available as well as a recording of the webinar. So.
Okay, great.
Did you want to give them your website address?
You know, if you just type in Indiana Resource Center for Autism, mm-hmm. you will find the website.
Okay. And as I scroll down, I see that you're about halfway down the page, a picture of you and an About Kathy link. So you know you're there when you see Kathy in the little green box.
and you can also see my email is there too, so if people want to email me at any time. I have that crackberry addiction, or blackberry addiction, so I'm happy to email. So
now, functional behavioral assessments, are those only to be used in the school setting or can they be used at home as well?
You know, I think here's what I feel about functional behavioral assessment. It is lovely that it became law for schools, but it is also awful that it became law for schools, because then all of a sudden people start thinking about it as a form. You know, what is the form? Who fills out the form? How many copies of the form? You know, how many days to fill out the form? And what I tell people is that anytime you have anybody in your life who starts acting differently or unpredictably, a functional behavioral assessment, all it is asking a lot of questions to try to figure out why is this behavior happening. Mm-hmm. It's just brainstorming to try to figure out what that underlying cause is. Schools have forms with a lot of different questions. I have to tell you that some of the questions that are most helpful for me, and we will ask questions like, when does this behavior happen? When does this behavior happen? Who does this behavior happen with? How long does it last? You know, all those things. But some of the questions that are most helpful for me are, tell me when this child is being really successful, what's happening? What's going on when they're having a really good day or a really good hour or a really good 5 minutes? And the other thing that is really helpful for me to know is, what are their interests? What are their fixations? What are their strengths? Because if I can start identifying them, I can start connecting with kids. I can start getting into their world and getting a little bit more connected with them and start developing a program based around those strengths. Mm-hmm. So I think it's a mindset. I mean, again, when I have a friend who they start acting differently, we all do it. We'll say, so what's going on in your world? And that's really what functional behavioral assessment is. It's just trying to figure out, why is my kid doing this? What's the payoff? What are they getting from this? What purpose is it serving? You know, is it the way that they communicate? Is it related to sensory issues? Is it related to medication? What's going on with this? And that's really what a functional behavioral assessment is. It's just that we formalized it for schools.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I wanted to let our callers know, the ones that are using the telephone, that you can press *2 now at any time if you'd like to raise your hand to ask a question of Kathy regarding behavior. Now, remember, she can't address anything specific to your child, but generalization, you know, some general behavioral questions or tactics or things like that, you know, we can certainly address. She'll do her best. And interspersed with those live questions, we will address some of these questions that have been submitted through the website as well. So we actually have a caller that would like to ask a question, Kathy. I will unmute them. Hi, caller, you're on. Can you say your first name and where you're calling from?
Jimmy, and I'm calling from Louisiana.
Welcome.
Thank you. My question is, I've used spanking on my son, and he's 5 years old, and he has autism. I try to spank him when it's something life-threatening or harming to others, but I noticed that he has picked up spanking himself and saying, stop that. And I was wondering, what can I do about that?
Yeah, I think that's always the danger, is that kids will model our behavior. And I've seen other kids who, when they are spanked or we use more aggressive methods with them, they will start spanking themselves or other people. So that's not unusual. I think, again, you have to go back and think about, well, let me address it in two ways. First of all, if your child is going to hurt themselves, they're going to run out in front of traffic, or something dangerous is going to happen, you have to have some approach to stop them. You have to keep them safe. But then you have to go back and think about, you know, is spanking really going to be the best process for keeping them safe, and what are they going to be learning from the spanking? So always when you do that kind of a generic punishment, at the same time you have to start making sure that your child has alternative skills, that they have alternative behaviors, that you are teaching them different ways of responding to things. Don't stop with the negative. Think about, what is it that you want to teach? And you have to, again, go back and do the assessment. Figure out what skill is your child lacking where they're putting themselves in dangerous situations. How do you help them to identify danger? How do you help them to not do those things? How do you help them to understand to stay away from that stuff? So that is a danger, and I think always with our kids, you have to think about, what are they learning from us?
Okay, that's a really good question, because safety is always such an issue with our kids. I know mm-hmm. with my son, we used to just have to form a corral around him, because if you grabbed his hand in a parking lot or tried to, he would run.
Right.
He had no sense of danger at all.
And it becomes a game.
Mm-hmm.
For these kids. And, you know, if they, you know, these kids like to see our buttons pushed, you know? Yeah. And what is the adage? If you don't want a kid to push your buttons, don't show them where they are. And, you know, I think we have to be careful because, you know, our getting upset or excited about something will only make the behavior occur more often. One of my staff was talking about that she was in a school and one of the students said, a lovely obscenity that I won't repeat on this phone call. And she, you know, her gut instinct was to respond to it, but she thought, you know, if I respond, this kid's going to just keep doing this more and more. So.
Yeah, that's the way it is with typical kids as well, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
Mm-hmm. I'm afraid. Okay, we have another caller with a question, hand raised. Hi, caller. You're on. Can you say your first name and where you're calling from? Hello?
Hello?
Yes, hi. You have a question for Kathy?
Oh, yes. My name is Kathy. I'm calling from Illinois. I'm wondering what she knows about the effects of restraining a child face down and the effects emotionally and socially to everybody else that's watching them.
Restraining the child face down?
Yes.
Okay. Is it a school-age child?
Yes.
Okay. Now, be mindful of the fact that I don't know this situation. So I will just tell you some generic responses to this. There is a lot of concern about the use of restraint and seclusion for students with all types of disabilities. Numerous states, and I think that Illinois has actually enacted legislation that articulates when and how seclusion and restraint should be used. And part of the reason that there has been this fear over the use of seclusion and restraint is that there have been events where kids have died.
Right.
They have, you know, there was a child who hung himself in a timeout room. Children who have been restrained face down, who have suffocated, and so what the legislation says is basically this: is that if a child is being restrained, first of all, the staff should have training in crisis prevention. And crisis prevention doesn't do face-down restraints. Okay? The second thing that needs to happen is that families need to be informed when that kind of a restraint is being used. And the third thing that the legislation really promotes is that at the same time that restraint or seclusion is being used, that there should be positive behavior support approaches in place, teaching kids alternative ways. The other thing is that the schools are supposed to collect data on how often those strategies are used. So, you know, again, you know, safety always being the first concern, but I personally, having been a teacher for many years, am concerned when kids are restrained face down.
It's brought on more anxiety. It's brought on more anxiety, which it's just like doubled, which now he's looking at the other kids, hitting other kids, because they're all looking at what's going on, and it could be prevented.
Right. Well, I think the other thing, the anxiety, because a child is waiting for, excuse me, when am I going to be punished, what's going to happen? I mean, it's kind of like threats. Threats or anything punitive will only heighten anxiety for our students. And I really think that, and again, these are my beliefs, that a lot of our program is about how to diminish anxiety. The other thing that to me is really critical is self-esteem. And I don't know your son or daughter, but I know that many of the kids that I know they're different and they don't like being different and they don't like to be pointed out as being different by their classmates. And so when they are in those situations, it only heightens their anxiety. So.
Does a green light system work or give more anxiety to it?
Well, tell me how they're going to use the green light system.
Green is he's being good. Yellow, maybe he's reaching out and swatting them away during direction. Red is that you stepped on my foot and you're kicked at me.
Okay.
And then red leads to restraining on the floor.
Okay. you know, okay, so I'm just generically going to talk about response cost programs. And
okay.
response cost programs, because I'm working in a school right now where they have a response cost program. So with response cost programs, generically what happens is that kids have so many cards, and they can be different colors. And so then the first infraction, they have to flip a card, and that could be the green card. And then the next time they have an infraction, they have to flip a card. And that may then result in something more punitive. What I have seen with response cost programs is that they have a tendency to heighten anxiety. So I'm actually working with the principal in this school that we're going to do away with the response cost programs school-wide, because kids never know how they can earn cards, how they can earn points. It's like once they have lost something, then there's no way that they can act right to get something back. Does that make sense?
Right, right. That sounds just like the green light program, yes.
Yeah, so we're actually going to change it so that students are earning things. But the other thing with response cost programs that I have found, and again, I don't know in this school, but sometimes with response cost programs, kids really don't know why they are losing privileges.
Okay.
The rules have not been operationally defined enough so that the students understand. So sometimes what happens is that randomly they lose a card or they're given a card, and they have no idea why, and so that will only heighten their anxiety, too, if they're not clear about why they're exactly losing a card. Does that make sense to you?
It makes perfect sense, but then how do you change
okay.
it, and how do you reduce the anxiety that you – I guess what I need to know is how do you regulate them so they know, okay, calm down before you get to this point?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, when they are not upset, when a child is not upset, that's when you start teaching them different strategies. So let me just give you an example of this. There is a little guy that I've worked with for a lot of years. And he got upset and had a behavioral meltdown in school. And everybody was really, you know, at that moment, it's like, what do we do with this behavior? How do we deal with it? And for him, at that moment, I knew that he is not a kid who will become aggressive. At that moment, I just said, you know, let him calm down and regroup. And then when he has calmed down, when things are okay, we have been working with him on social narratives and with role playing to help him identify. Have you seen the 5-point scale also?
No, I've been looking for that book. I need to order it. I can't find it anywhere. That's exactly what I'm looking for, of him to understand, okay, I'm right here, I feel this way.
Mm-hmm. To get the 5-point scale, because it's through AAPC, actually, there is a website. Nancy, do you have a way to generically get information out to people?
Yes.
Okay. There's a website, Nancy, that I'll send you tomorrow. No, I won't, not tomorrow, because I've got training the next 2 days, but I'll send you this weekend. There is a school that we've worked in Indiana that one of my staff actually developed a lot of visual supports for them, and there's all different kinds of visual supports that are either available through BoardMaker or through Word, and families can use those for free. And but I will send you that website, okay?
Okay.
With directions on how to use it. But the Carrie Dunn-Barone book, which is the 5-point scale, that is available through AAPC Publishing. And you use that 5-point scale to help them understand, you know, understand the ideas, the feelings around when they're going through the escalation of behaviors.
Okay. You know, a lot of these things are happening because of the fact that it's social time. It's social, it's circle time, it's gym time, it's joining a group.
Unstructured time.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, it's all dealing with social happenings, and I'm worried
right.
that because of all the restraining, it's like a bigger barrier, because you've seen what they've been doing, and
mm-hmm.
now you want me to join you.
The other thing that I'm going to suggest to you is that, and this is available on the Autism Society website, is that I think one of the things that I really push for in schools is to do disability awareness And that's not to say, let's talk about the neurology of autism, but I think that if classmates have some understanding, and you work with the school on the classmates having some understanding about your child's disability, that may be helpful. But if you have a hard time locating those pamphlets, email me and I'll connect you with them.
Okay. Well, how would you get that child? How would you get that child to be part of a social group?
You know, I think that we organize different social things with kids, like having them eat with other kids at lunchtime, finding kids that will hook up with the child. There are evidence-based practices that we use around peer-mediated instruction, where we teach kids how to interact. We involve them in problem-solving around kids. But I think educating, I guess what I'm trying to say is, we too often put all the social responsibility on the child with autism. And we expect them to pull the line. And here they have social deficits. Social interactions are a two-way street. And so in addition to teaching the child social skills, we also have to make sure that we are teaching the students without challenges how to interact with the child with autism.
So probably the more with non-disabled peers is the better to go with social.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Paula.
Okay, I thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Kathy, I think the website you want me to share is probably called Boardmaker Share.
It actually isn't. It's a school district that I'm going to send you the link for. It's www.hbm.org. It's Hamilton Boone Madison, and they have an autism team that somebody who is now my staff member developed a lot of visual supports. So, but I will send you that in the instructions on how to get there.
Oh, okay. Okay, we have another caller that's interested in asking a question. And we will take another call, and then I'll go to the web questions for a couple of questions that way. Hello, caller. Hello?
Hello, Kathy.
Hello.
I have my son who is 9 years old, and we went through the entire, everything that you discussed, I just relived in my heart and in my mind, and it was just terrible. But I'd like to tell you that the cards, they work while they're small. As they get older and they start changing, we have to change as well, and they don't always work, and we have to be able to bring to them an opportunity to show us what they like, and once they know what we know what they like, to use, like you said, that as a reinforcement. But when my son is going through a meltdown, we use a lot of distraction, and we start, like, talking amongst ourselves, you know, saying things that he likes, like what his favorite food is, like Wendy's. We can calm the world with Wendy's. I heard what that parent was saying about the restraints. I was wondering, what do you think of virtual school? Do you think that that might be something that might come for children that are on the higher functioning level, as opposed to sending them into that social environment of what would be middle school, high school, and so on? What do you think of virtual school for our children?
You know, here's what I think is such an individualized decision. So let me argue the pros and cons of it. You know, for some of our kids, the school setting is so challenging that there are students that I have seen who I've just said, you know, it probably would be, and for whatever reason it is, maybe the school experience was really bad, you know, they've been abused in the school setting or whatever, that we need to look at something that's more restrictive. The other hand, I have to tell you, you know, in education, we have a tendency to recycle through ideas, and we sometimes forget the lessons that we've learned. And, you know, when special education first came around, we did a lot of segregation of kids. That was our model, is that we segregated students. And what we found is, and the research was very clear, is that when you segregate them during the school years, that ends up that they end up then graduating into segregated life options. So as much as possible, and this is going to be a balancing act for each child, is that individuals have to be in context to learn because our folks don't generalize. And I think that our job is not to restrict their life, but to enrich it and to teach strategies both for them and for the people who support them. And I am, again, very driven by the fact, and here is a reality, about 80% of our folks with disabilities, including those on the spectrum at all different stages of the spectrum, are unemployed. And in a study in Indiana, when we looked at the income level for our folks, the average annual income was $6,700 a year. And the reason that our folks have the greatest difficulty maintaining employment is not because they don't do a task well, because these are folks who can do a task well and continue to do it well. The problem is the social engagement, understanding the rules of the workplace. So removing them from all opportunities for them to learn those things, I don't know, I'm really challenged by that. You know, I think that, you know, we have to be in there as a community and helping folks learn the skills that they're going to need lifelong. So.
I agree, and I thank you for that, because I've been struggling with that, wondering what's going to happen with him as he enters mm-hmm. middle school, and as his body starts changing, what's going to happen with his moments when he has a meltdown, and how are they going to hold him, and will they tell me, will they call me right away so that I can go and help? I'm just afraid of not being there for him, and what could happen with the response, because in school, the reality is some schools are well-equipped to deal with them, and they have the staff that has the knowledge and understanding of the patients, and in other schools, they don't have that. And mm-hmm. I guess that's what my fear is, you know, as he was 8 years old and going into a little school that had two floors, he almost jumped out the second floor window as everybody's corralling him. And, mm-hmm. and you know, it's scary. I'm in fear for it, so thank you for that. I just have to keep looking at what's best for him.
Well, I think that, you know, that you, the school needs to tell you, school needs to tell you very clearly and document what it is that they plan to do with your child. And that's a discussion, and I think that's a good discussion for all families to have, is to say, you know, there's two conversations. One is, when my child has a meltdown, when they have a behavioral episode, what is it that will happen that will minimize the situation and keep my child safe? Okay? And then the second part of it is, what is the behavior support plan that is going to focus on teaching him a different way of responding? And again, I can't say to you strongly enough, when I look at IEP goals around behavior, people are very good at writing IEP goals that say the child will stop running, they'll stop hitting, they'll stop doing this. You have to be able to write an IEP goal that articulates what is the pro-social behavior that a child will learn. What are the communication skills? We have to be able to identify that alternative behavior, that replacement behavior. Because if we can't, don't expect the child to learn it.
No, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. And when I ask, what coping skills is, how do you teach him? What are you teaching him? Oh, they say to me, oh, well, we go above and beyond, although we don't have it on paper, it's on the daily interaction that we teach him, but I don't mm-hmm. see that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I mean, I try to keep a good rapport with the school, I try to keep a good rapport with them, but in reality, what comes first is his safety and how well he can do, and sometimes, I like I said, it's just a fear as the body starts changing for him and he starts getting older and they become more aggressive and their mindset is different. I'm afraid that one day I might not even be able to control him. And mm-hmm. it's just a matter of getting him out there.
And that's, you know, that's the danger of when I said to you all, you know, we have to be careful about getting into this control mindset, because when they're little, we move them around because they're easy to move around. And then as they get bigger, I hear schools and families talking about, you know, we need to have a male with him, we need to have a big person. And, you know, my plea is for folks who are working with younger kids is, you know, don't try to focus on how we're going to control the behavior. Focus on how we're going to help the child be able to control their own behavior. You know, how are they going to be able to be distracted? How are they going to be able to know how to calm themselves down? That's really what we need to help these kids understand.
Right. Just, I guess I need to figure out what techniques, because he's outgrown the cards. He's outgrown those little signal things, and I need to figure out what techniques to use for him. I mean, he won't even sit with us when people are eating or when anybody's eating. To him, his sensory issues, it's just he can't handle that. He can't handle to watch people chewing or the smell of food, and he can't have things touching, just the typical things. But people just don't have patience for that. And just one little trigger will set him off, and there goes the day, and there goes, you know, everything.
But that's because he's on edge. You know, it's like those setting events. For him, the setting events is sensory. So if they could build in sensory programming more into his day, maybe he wouldn't be triggered so quickly.
Thank you for that. Thank you so much. And thank you for your webinar. It was amazing. I think you're one of the first people that I've heard in a while that speak reality. I mean, things that we were dealing with, I was just reliving everything you were saying, and you had an explanation for it, and some techniques I was using, and so I'm grateful for that. Thank you. I hope we do have another one.
Thank you, Paula. Okay, let's see what questions have been coming in through the website. We have a question from Carmel in Arizona. She asks, are social stories and power card strategies really helpful in decreasing disruptive behaviors in children with autism?
You know, there was just some research that came out that said social narratives, social stories, social narratives is kind of the generic form for it, but social stories, when done in isolation, are not totally helpful. I think that they are incredibly helpful. But, for example, I'm working with a guy right now who has a host of behavioral issues, and he's a really bright guy. And, you know, let me just give you one as an example, although there's many others that he does. But he, in class, he just will randomly say irrelevant things. And so we actually did some social cartooning with him to help him understand what other kids may be thinking of him when he does that. We've done a social narrative with him about raising his hand. We're also doing some coaching with him to get him to raise his hand. And then the fourth thing that we're talking about doing is some video self-modeling, where he is really into being a director, and, you know, he's, even though he's like 10, and making movies. So we're going to have him direct a movie, just using a flip camera, but direct a little video about how he's going to teach the other kids how to raise their hands. Mm-hmm. So, you know, these things, you know, it's we're looking at, always you look at what is the problem, what is the outcome you want to achieve, and then we looked at a host of ideas and suggestions for addressing that behavior.
Very nice. We also have a question here from Ellen in Yorkville. How can you tell if the problem is medical or behavioral in a nonverbal autistic person?
Boy, you don't know.
You don't know.
I don't know how to detect that. I mean, I think, you know, when you have a child who has behavioral difficulties, again, that's where, you know, the functional behavioral assessment, and when they can't tell you, you just have to dig deep. And I think that you address all aspects of it, trying to figure out what's going on. And again, work with the team, because what I find is that when the team sits down, you'll see people coming up with ideas that when you start putting them together, you start getting a picture of what's going on with the behavior. But, you know, it's hard to tell, and it's hard to know what the underlying medical stuff will be. I mean, and I've seen, for example, I've worked with students who are nonverbal who will hit themselves in the head, and then I found out that it related to chronic ear infections. So you almost have to become a mind reader to try to read their behaviors to see what message they're giving to us.
Mm-hmm.
But there is nothing that says this is how you can tell that the behavior is due to medical or their disability or to what they've learned. Again, behavior is something that they've learned over time.
Right. Yeah, my son's behavior becomes part of the routine.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, he goes to speech therapy. He has a tantrum as soon as he walks in the door, and then he can transition into speech.
Mm-hmm. We have yet to discover how to skip over the behavior part and just go right into speech.
Yeah, it's almost like, you know, these kids who get obsessive compulsive behaviors that they have to do two steps before they go out the door.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just becomes part of the routine.
Yeah,
that tantrum is part of it. We've even tried, like, going straight in and having McDonald's in the break room
mm-hmm.
before speech, thinking, okay, we'll interrupt that by adding in another component. Well, that just delays the tantrum from now he tantrums going from the break room to the speech room.
mm-hmm.
So he's a very, very difficult case. So we'll just keep working at it. We have a question from Seema in Atlanta, and we've come across this ourselves. I think this is very common in families. And us as parents, we're not trained in, you know, positive restraints or whatever it is called, PB. What is it called when you
crisis prevention?
Crisis prevention, when you can yeah. restrain someone without hurting them or yourself.
Mm-hmm.
So Seema from Atlanta asks, how to control severe tantrums either at home or outside? And I know that, you know, if there's a school delay, my son stays home because it takes two people to get him out the door and on the bus without bodily
mm-hmm.
injury to anyone.
Mm-hmm.
So I think this is a very common question. I know, you know, we keep the child safe.
Right.
But if you just have to get from here to there, there's going to be a tantrum.
Yeah, the problem is that for some of your children, they may be so large, you're putting yourself in danger too.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I get concerned about. Again, you know, I can't say strongly enough that, you know, you're going to have to deal with whatever situation you're in at the moment. And as someone who used to work with really aggressive folks, I know there are times where you just have to kind of move them through and make things happen. But then when the behavior's not happening, you've got to figure out what's going on so that you're not continually in a mode where you're having to manhandle and address the behavior. Because when you're in that pattern, it's very difficult to break it. But what your child is also learning some things that you don't want them to learn long term. And what you're ultimately having to think about is how is he going to be 30 years from now when I'm not around? And so how am I going to teach him some other ways of responding? And Nancy, I've worked with really aggressive kids through my lifetime, you know, and I have been hurt by kids. But I've always found that with students who have challenging behaviors, when you get to the heart, when you finally can figure out what's going on and you can start addressing the behavior in a more pro-social way, you'll see things really turn around. And, you know, and I also, again, with autism, we look at autism as a whole body condition, too. You know, so there may be something chemically or there may be something that needs to happen for a kid sometimes. I am not a great supporter of medications.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you and I were talking about that a little bit before. But I have to tell you that there are times, and I look at these kids and I think they will be grateful if they're on medications because I don't think that these kids like to feel that out of control. I don't think that they like to feel that much anxiety. And for our listeners, the analogy that I use, my mom is 88 and has some dementia, and she can get kind of nasty with us. And there was an event that happened over the holidays that we finally put her on some medication to help calm her. And I have to tell you, I look at her now, and she is so much happier, because she didn't like being that agitated. So, but I do see, you know, looking at the whole person, knowing sometimes there may be other things that need to happen for the child to get them to the place where they can respond more positively and proactively. You know, looking at, is there something medically going on with your child? Do they have some issues that need to be dealt with in some kind of way? But I think, my personal belief is that I think that when kids are that out of control, it's not something that they enjoy.
Mm-hmm. And there's a question that I want to piggyback off of this is, Katie from Illinois asks, the child is aggressively pinching or scratching when instruction is given to work at school. She wants to know if this can be a learned behavior after ignoring has not worked for 6 years. How do we now stop this?
Yeah, but you want to look at, you know, what is he getting out of doing it? What is the payoff on it? You know, I mean, if kids do these behaviors because they get something from it, so what's his payoff that he's getting? You know, is he able to escape the task? Is he getting a strong reaction from staff? You know, somehow or another, he's learned that this behavior is serving a purpose for him.
Mm-hmm. It's
so
probably escape, but
yeah. And but it can also be attention. You know, you pinch or, you know, scratch a teacher, and they give you a strong reaction. You know.
Yeah.
And that's funny. You know, that's funny to some of our kids.
Wow. Okay. Callers, again, if you have a question you'd like to ask Kathy, just push *2, and that will signal me that you have a question you'd like to ask. We do have a caller with their hand raised. Let me see if I can get them on the line here. Hi, caller. Did you have a question for Kathy? Caller? Hello? I will go back to the internet questions. There's a lot of questions regarding dealing with nonverbal children and aggressive behavior. And do you believe that that's probably related somehow to their inability to communicate effectively?
Oh, absolutely. I think that getting a communication system in place for a child is absolutely critical. And I think, you know, a system that can be available all the time. One of the evidence-based practices that we see for folks with autism is something called functional communication training. And what functional communication training is, that it uses a functional behavioral assessment approach to think about when the child is upset, how do they communicate that? If they want food, how do they communicate that? And so you think about if they use their behavior to communicate, then you think about how you create a communication system that they can start using that system instead of their behaviors to communicate messages that are important to them. So, but use an FBA process. And the hard thing about, you know, building in those communication systems is that people have to really embed them into the culture so that they have to be available for a child at all times. Unfortunately, sometimes when we build communication systems for kids, we only use them now and again, or we don't have the device available for all students. I'm also going to tell you, and this is, again, my bias, is that if I were the parent of a child with autism and my child had speech twice a week, I would be furious. If they had it 3 times a week, I'd be livid. If they had it 5 times a week for 30 minutes, I would be angry beyond belief. Because families, the question you should be asking is not how much speech therapy my child gets. The question you should be asking is, how is communication embedded across the day? Do not reduce it to them having therapy services, but it should be embedded across the day. You know, when I was a teacher, my speech clinician helped me think about how I embedded augmentative systems so that my students in all different kinds of situations could communicate, and for those students who were verbal, how we would set things up so that they would learn how to initiate conversation.
Are you still there, Kathy?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, good. My phone went quiet, and I thought I'd lost you. We have a caller with a question. Let me see if I can get them on the line here. Hello, caller. Did you have a question today?
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This is my second question. So this is Baton Rouge, Louisiana again. First of all, thank you, Kathy. The webinar is really great, and I love the insight you're giving, especially on learning behavior of your child and about communication. My question is about communication. My son has a system of communication as far as when he needs something. He's learning words because he is nonverbal, but he's actually learning words so he can sound out computer, which gives me a hint he wants to get on a computer, and he can bring me the food to let me know what he wants. But my question is, I'm curious in investing in an iPod to help him with his communication because I want him to develop more communication system across the board that will help him when he's not with me. But his teachers are butt, and his speech therapist at school is a butt person, and they always giving me butt is going to hinder his progress that he's made so far. And I'm looking more of a, for and answers on why I should instead of should not.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I think that there has been at different times beliefs that if you give a child an augmentative communication system, that will hinder verbal, their verbal, gaining verbal skills. What you need to know is that the research absolutely doesn't prove that. That, you know, it really is best, enrich your child with lots of different ways to communicate. Because if they don't have a system, you know, and again, I don't care if they use, you know, there are people who believe, you know, they should either just use sign or they should just either use pictures. I have to tell you that I would use everything. And just so that my child would have an opportunity. I think that the iPod and iPad, I think that, you know, what's interesting about the iPod is they run, is it like a couple hundred dollars?
Mm-hmm. Well, not very expensive at all.
Yeah, like assistive communication devices are a couple thousand dollars.
Oh.
iPads are $500, $600. You know, augmentative communication systems are, you know, several thousand dollars. So some of this new technology that's coming out actually does some really nice stuff for much less expensive than what augmentative systems do. There is, and I'm not going to remember this, there's a, I'm not going to remember the name of it, but there is an app that is like Pro Logistics or something.
Prologue 2.
And that is actually like an augmentative system. Nancy, is it?
Mm-hmm. But yes, it is.
My understanding of it, though, is that still you need somebody who will program it and do some things because it's not as, you know, quite as easy as maybe some of the other augmentative systems are. But still, that's amazing, the price. And I think, you know, we have just seen kids really respond to these iPods and iPads. I think it's great.
One quick before I let somebody else get in. My teacher, or my son's teacher, he's in early pre-K and autism secluded class setting. There's a possibility he can go into a fully included kindergarten class because he's progressed so far with his language to where he can, if he's prompted, he can do tasks. But one of the issues she's concerned about is motivation because with her by his side, she can motivate him to do the work by positive reinforcements, as you touched on, and give him cues because he loves praise. But she's afraid that in a regular setting, the teacher is not going to be able to do that, and she's considering keeping him in that autism class secluded setting. And I just wanted to hear what you thought about that.
Well, it sounds like your child is pretty prompt dependent. If somebody needs to sit next to them to prompt them. And
uh-huh.
there's always a danger in somebody becoming too prompt dependent. So, you know, my question would be is how do we start weeding some of those prompts from your child being dependent on an adult being there to some more visual prompts. So let me give you an example of this. There is a second grader that I've been working with who is very prompt dependent on staff telling him what page to turn to and, you know, to get his book out and all that kind of stuff. So we're actually designing some visual supports that he will have at his desk that we can start fading staff off of and start fading him onto those visual supports. Because visual supports are a kind of prompt that he can have with him for the rest of his life. So, and I think, you know, the other thing is that really what the school years are about, I mean, learning, they're about gaining a whole lot of skills, but they're also about us figuring out when your child is in a typical community, what are the kinds of supports that they're going to need? And so the best way to do that, I think, is to have them in the midst of it. Let me also say, because, you know, I know I'm very pro having kids involved with others. I have seen good programs in inclusive and segregated settings. I've seen bad programs in inclusive and segregated settings. So to me, it's not so much about whether it's a segregated or inclusive setting. It's about having people who are really trained, who have a passion for this, who have an understanding. But if you look at all things being equal, an inclusive or a segregated setting, I think that as much as we can have kids in inclusive settings, it will help them to prepare for life. I know that sometimes it does benefit kids, and there are times where I say to parents, I think that your son or daughter needs some more intensive work in this area, so let's pull them for a little bit. But then always let's talk about how they can practice those in the midst of other kids.
Thank you. That was awesome.
Thank you, caller. Now, Kathy, I can speak for just a moment from a parent's perspective on the iPod.
Mm-hmm.
As an assistive technology specialist for Goodwill Easter Seals, I dealt with a lot of the augmentative devices.
Mm-hmm.
And I know that they're time-consuming to program. They can be very static and unwielding. They're rather large, most of them. And the iPod, like you said, is more reasonably priced. It is much more flexible in that it can hold communication devices, picture schedules, if-then schedules. You know, you can take pictures and put actual pictures of things and places and people on there that your child is familiar with. It can hold full-length movies for times you're waiting in line at the grocery store or at the doctor's office. It's just so much more flexible. And it's also, you know, it's what everybody has. It's the same thing that their peers have. So I'm a huge proponent of using the technology that's available to us out there.
Well, the other thing that I've seen is that when kids have it, it's a good connector with other kids because you'll see kids come up and want to look at it and want to do things with it, too. So it kind of bridges some of that relationship stuff, too.
Absolutely. I know when my son has his iPod, my nephews, my typical nephews, are gathered around wanting to see what he's doing, what he's looking at. But, I mean, there's story readers and just so many apps that you can get. And it just opens the world up for them. I'm a huge proponent. And I know, too, when Sam couldn't talk, we used everything, like you said. We used sign. We used pictures. We used, you know, language. I just wanted him to have a way to communicate. I didn't care what it was, and it really didn't stop him from talking. It actually increased his verbalization because it reduced his stress.
Right.
And he's 13, he still, when he gets frustrated, will sign help or more or whatever the sign is because he's lost the ability to speak. He's so angry.
Right.
So it's kind of funny.
None of us use one system to communicate. We use facial expressions, we use gestures, we use, you know, our words, we use our behaviors, we use our actions, you know. So, and, you know, when any of us are upset, sometimes we will go back to some of those more, you know, to those facial expressions or those gestures or their behaviors. And that's going to be true for these kids as well. So.
Absolutely. Yeah, I just wanted to speak to that for a minute because I know there's a huge misconception out there that teaching sign or using some other system like PECS will take away language, and it's just not true.
Right.
It's just not true. Okay, we have another caller. Let's see what this is. Hello, caller. You're on with Kathy.
Hello.
Hi.
I did buy a iPad, even though school said it's not going to work. It's going to hinder his language. But it has, just like with PECS system, it has brought out more language in him. Just want to throw that in. but my question is, if you have a child that spent 6 years in a teach setting, self-contained classroom, independent work, and then because they were academically higher, put them into a regular classroom, will that show anxiety and aggression?
Wait, say that one again.
A child being in a teach classroom.
Okay.
In a self-contained classroom where teach boxes are pretty much you're independent working. and then you put a child after all those years into a classroom setting and say, okay, sit here, here's your work. Would that bring out anxiety of not understanding what am I supposed to do?
You know, I think, again, it's not whether it's in a segregated or integrated classroom. I think it's a matter of how things are set up. I have somebody on my staff who is a teach trainer and worked for Teach for a lot of years. And, you know, we will go in and have gone in and created some of the teach structure in general education settings as well. So I think it's just a matter of that one is not better than the other. It's a matter of how the structure is created for the student in that setting. So taking what you've learned from him being in a segregated setting and then applying it in the next setting.
So he went from just being independently working with teach boxes and then having to sit in rows of class, you know, classmates.
Mm-hmm.
And here's your worksheet.
Is he doing it?
No, aggression came out.
Okay, so then I think that I would be talking to the staff to say, you know, let's talk about what works for him. And can we replicate this in the classroom?
Can you move it from a teach setting into a regular classroom eventually? Can it
be
brought into?
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, where
is
the stop? It can be, okay.
I mean, I think that it just, because the teach is just about organizing physical structure, and it's also about organizing workstations, and it's about organizing schedules, and it's, you know, it's even about how you do accommodations on worksheets. It's just, you know, the idea behind teach is that children with autism like structure, predictability, and routine. And so they create different work systems to create that structure and predictability and routine. So if you can emulate that in the general education setting, then a child can be successful. And I've been involved in doing that before.
Okay, great. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, caller.
Can I just add one thing?
Sure.
My staff and I do a lot of work in schools, and I know this is not going to surprise you all, but sometimes the students who are the most difficult are not your children with autism. Schools have a lot of kids who are pretty tough, kids who have mental illness. I've been working with some kids who are truly sociopaths, and so as I go into schools, I go through the door of autism. I come on behalf of kids with autism, but a lot of the strategies that we promote for kids with autism work with other kids as well. And we refer to that as universal design. So there is a school north of Indianapolis, just as an example, that as a school, they are using visual supports for all kids. Mm-hmm. And because they found that by putting visual supports in the school, that it benefits not just the students with autism, but every child, students with and without disabilities. And so, you know, I think that a lot of these strategies to help people see that they can work for anybody. It's not just for our kids with autism. There's a lot of kids in our schools who have really poor social skills. And one of the things that I was working with, I think I mentioned to you about one student, was kind of understanding social perspective through social cartooning. Well, the social worker looked at that and said, I'm going to use this with a bunch of other kids as well because they don't understand how their behavior is being perceived by others. So I think, you know, helping them, you know, for me, helping schools understand that these are strategies that just work. They're good things for kids.
Yeah, one of the biggest challenges as a parent is not having letters after my name.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm not taken seriously.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and parents are the experts. You say,
mm-hmm.
you know, you worry about that label, the expert, but parents really are because we have to.
Mm-hmm.
We have to know everything about everything.
Mm-hmm.
And
you know your child 24/7.
Right. And, you know, we do so much research in,
mm-hmm.
you know, what's working and what doesn't work, and schools just don't have the time to do or the need or the desire to go into that much in-depth research. So you come in the door with, you know, information that visual supports will help all students, and they look at you with dollar signs in their eyes and say, you know, we don't want to put out the money to do that. We don't, you know, we disagree. That's a huge obstacle for families.
But I think, you know, again, I'm going to be sending you visuals that were put together by a school district, by school staff, that have been embedded universally. And we did it, we've embedded them in a middle school and now have taken them up to a freshman center and also into a high school. So I think, you know, again, just going back to the leadership of the schools, you know, and if you can get folks that will engage the leadership in talking about different ways of educating, I think it can make a difference. There are good-hearted people out there. I think right now what you need to all understand is, you know, just look at the media. Teachers are feeling pretty beaten up these days. So with funding reduced and being reduced and stuff. So, you know, hopefully we can all be on the same side working on behalf of kids.
Yeah, I know that. Well, I feel that teachers really do want to learn and really want to learn strategies because it's only going to benefit them in the long run. But districts don't have the funds to send them to teach training or to implement a lot of these strategies. So it really is up to the parents to bring in the supports. That's what I find anyway. When I went online, I did... I just Googled HBM Board Maker, and it pulled up the link to the HBM homepage, Mosaics Board Maker Templates. So until we get that information to share, I just wanted people to know that they could just Google HBM Board Maker, and it will get you in the right direction for those Board Maker Templates. We will share that information, though, when it becomes available to us. And we have a lot of questions about, you know, it is pretty much, you know, the getting the horse and the cart mixed up here because so many people want answers to the behavior. How do I stop this behavior? And it really is about figuring out the antecedent, isn't it?
Well, it's really, yeah, it's really trying to figure out what that underlying cause is and trying to figure out what the payoff is for the child. And then and again, I'll tell you, 1,000% of the time when I get asked a question about behavior, as I start digging, I find more and more. And then finally, you gather enough information so that a procedure or a strategy or idea or solution just evolves from it. So you've got to dig to figure out the questions. I think, or what's going on. I think too often what happens is that we just generically apply strategies without thinking about what is really the problem and what is it that we really hope to achieve. And Nancy, I can't say it to you strongly enough. You have to be able to identify what you want your child to do instead. Because if you don't, then the behavior won't go away. If you only focus on getting rid of a problem behavior, and you don't give them an alternative behavior, they will fill that space with something that may be worse than what you started out with.
Yeah, that's scary. That is scary. Go ahead.
Are there any other questions that are coming in?
Let me see.
It looks like we have about 9 minutes left.
Yeah, we'll wrap it up here in about 4 or 5 minutes, and then I will let everyone know how they can get a copy of this transcript. We do have one question. Let's go to the caller.
Okay.
Hello, caller. Did you have a question? No? Hello? Okay. I guess that caller does not have a question any longer. If anyone else has a last question they would like to ask, just press star 2, and that will alert me that you have a question you'd like to ask. We probably have time for maybe one more question. We do have one hand raised, so I'll go to that caller.
Gotcha.
Hi, caller.
Hi.
Did you have a question this evening?
Yes, I help my girlfriend with her daughter who has autism, and we try to engage her in, like, a movie night. We have, like, three families that get together with the children, and she just will not participate. She will, we have it quiet, so it's kind of like a routine for her, keep it calm, and she will just flip out, like, she's obsessed with different shows, or I want to go watch that, I don't want to watch this. And she'll just keep acting up and acting up and acting up until you take her out of the room. And then if you put her in a room to tell her, you know, calm your body down and come back, she'll, no, 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 I want to do this. Or how about if I do this, can I do that? Just, we don't know how to handle getting her to socialize with the other kids calmly.
Mm-hmm. So, when you're doing this, are there a lot of other kids in the setting? How many kids are in the setting?
We have three, four, five. There's six with her, and they're all, they can all be sitting quietly, and we're putting the movie on, and she'll come in, and we even give her the seat she wants.
Uh-huh.
But she will then, I don't want to do this. I want to go watch a different show that she's obsessed with that
uh-huh.
isn't appropriate for the other children. Or she wants to go call her friend. She has one friend that she talks to on the phone.
Mm-hmm.
She wants to call instead of doing whatever it is with these
mm-hmm.
kids. And we can have a potty. She'll go off to the side on her own.
Mm-hmm.
Unless she can be all over, say, the baby. It has to be what she wants at that moment.
Mm-hmm. I think, you know, again, I don't know why she's doing that. I would want to know, you know, how many people are in the environment. You know, she may be somebody that does better with just one-on-one instead of a group of folks. I know it's not unusual for me to hear that families will throw birthday parties for their child with autism, and their child with autism is up in their bedroom by themselves, and the party is going on without them because they have a hard time with it. And some of our folks will tell us that they need to be away from the party. So I think one of the things is thinking about what is socially comfortable for her. You know, she just may not be somebody who likes larger groups. But I don't know. Without knowing her, I don't know. But that's just my initial gut reaction on it.
Yeah, because she'll tell us, like, I'll sit and watch the movie if I can have one of the children sit with her. But if that child doesn't want to sit with her, then she is not going to sit and watch the show.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
And we try to explain to her that, you know, everybody has a choice, and if that person doesn't want to sit next to you, we can't force them to do that.
Right.
We try to give her boundaries. She's 12.
Yeah. Well, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, she's 12. So we're trying to set boundaries, and she doesn't want to hear the boundaries. She'll have a million excuses not to listen to the other children's boundaries.
Yeah. Well, you know, again, you know, it may not just be what's going on that night when you're doing the movie night. This may be an indicator of, you know, kind of those larger setting events that are going on with her. I mean, if she's 12, she's hitting that time of puberty, which is, you know, I know is a tough time for kids. It may be that she doesn't have the social skills to be able to do things. It may be that she's being in situations like that are very anxiety-producing. So you want to look overall at what's going on with the child, and it may not be anything directly related to that event. So,
I see.
But God love you for trying that. That's great.
Should we not try to push her into that? Should we not try to engage her with the other children?
No, I think that you keep trying, but I think that, you know, you also take some cues from her. Can she tell you what's comfortable for her and what's not?
Yeah, she can tell you that sometimes she'll say it's one kid because that kid's in the room, she don't want to be in the room.
Mm-hmm.
Another time it'll be because one of the little boy didn't want to sit with her.
Mm-hmm.
Another time it'll be that it's the movie. She doesn't want to watch that movie.
Those are just excuses.
Yes, exactly. And
when we try to get her to do something that she has to do, we'll tell her, you know, there's two ways of doing this. These are your two choices. She seems to handle that well. But when you try to engage her with other children, even if it's not her turn, okay, and you say to her, okay, you have to wait. It's this child's turn. Well, that's not fear. Everything is, that's not fear. That's her favorite thing. So no matter what the situation is, she has to always bring up, that's not fear. I want to do it because it should be my turn first.
So maybe that would be, you know, when I talked about the social cartooning, I mean, Cheryl Gray does that social cartooning. That might be helpful to help her understand other people's perspective, to say, you know, this is how you feel in this situation. Here's what other kids are thinking, you know, so that she can start getting outside of her own mindset to think about other people's perspective.
That's a good idea, yeah.
Okay. Thank you, caller.
Thank you.
Anyone else that we didn't get to your questions tonight, you can always go to the Indiana Resource Center for Autism website. Just Google Indiana Resource Center for Autism, and there's a link right in the center of the homepage where you can email Kathy directly. I want to thank you, Kathy, for joining us tonight. It's been such a delightful 2 hours talking about behaviors, which is always stressful.
Yeah.
But you always just make them so clear-cut and so simple that it's like one of those duh moments, like, what didn't I think of that? I always come away with some practical things I can try instead of making it all too complicated. So I appreciate you being here with us tonight, and hopefully we can have you back soon for more, because there's never enough time to talk about all the behavior issues that we all face. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
I want to let all of our listeners know that we'll be having a free, it's going to be like a web conference in April. I don't have a date for that yet, but we're still gathering speakers together and topics together, and just keep checking back, you know, to the website, momsfightingautism.com, and I'm sure it will be posted soon. And hopefully everyone will join us. Again, that'll be a free web conference for the month of April, which is Autism Awareness Month.